From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. What keeps you up at night?
If I look at my phone too long, or if I watch TV for too long, anytime I'm looking at a screen, it hurts my sleep. It gets your mind racing from what happened during the day.
We're going to be talking about the science of how to get a good night's rest today. First, though, we've talked in the show about Atlanta rapper Gucci Mane. He just put out a new autobiography and a new album.
He's kind of talking about the ways that we like to flirt with danger, right? And he's asking, what is it that attracts us to the dark side? And he's asking, and he's posing this question to himself, but he's also using illustrations of, you know, be it fans or, you know, people that he comes across, or, you know, being a former drug dealer and, you know, that whole lifestyle and how attractive it can be sometimes.
That is NPR's hip-hop writer Rodney Carmichael. Here are your first thoughts. Matt Mickelveen writes, Gucci Mane was incarcerated for having loaded firearms as an already convicted felon, and then you celebrate and praise his music as if he's some kind of hero? Rap music glorifies guns, and young people are paying attention. We always love to get your opinion, so call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. You can also find us on Twitter or Facebook, and remember, we might feature your comments on the show. On Capitol Hill, the recently retired former head of Atlanta-based Equifax repeatedly apologized for his former company's massive and, at this point, growing data breach. Here is Richard Smith testifying Tuesday before the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee.
The criminal hack happened on my watch, and as CEO, I am ultimately responsible, and I take full responsibility. I'm here today to say to each and every person affected by this breach, that I'm truly and deeply sorry for what happened.
Reporter Tamar Harleman has been following this story. She's Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. It's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's unpack this a little bit, because it's not just that Equifax was Atlanta-based. It's also that this is pretty much affecting every consumer, adult consumer in the United States. You don't have a choice to opt in to Equifax or not. That's accurate, right? I mean, I saw people commenting, this doesn't affect me. I didn't use Equifax.
Exactly. As a consumer, you're not necessarily choosing to have your information stored, with one of these three companies, including Equifax. But since every bank and credit card company, they work with Equifax, you don't have a choice. Your information goes there anyway.
So let's talk about that information. There's a number of alarming things that came out of this testimony, I think. Let's talk first about this timeline, when Equifax knew what had happened and why it took so long. What kind of answers do we have on that question?
So one of the most amazing things looking at former CEO Rick Smith's testimony is for the first time he really did lay out a timeline for what happened. And what was so amazing was hearing that Equifax was tipped off back in March by the Department of Homeland Security that their system was vulnerable, that they needed to install a patch in some of the software that they were using. And what was pretty incredible is hearing the CEO or the former CEO say, well, we transferred it over, but the patch never happened.
So let's actually hear a little bit from his testimony. This is Richard Smith saying that there were both human and technological errors that made the system vulnerable.
The human error involved a failure to apply a software patch to our dispute portal in March of 2017. Technological error involved a scanner which failed to detect that vulnerability on that particular portal.
Okay, so another part of that wrinkle is, of course, did any of the board at Equifax then sell stock when they knew the hack had occurred before they informed consumers? Is that investigation still going forward?
So there were a few former executives, I believe it was two or three, who have since, I believe, left the company.
I think they all have, yep.
So it's really unclear, and that was something that the former CEO did not address in his testimony. One of the more striking things, from yesterday that really blew my mind, is going back to when the Department of Homeland Security told them in March they had a vulnerability, the former CEO blamed it on one person. who apparently was on their data security team, who was supposed to relay the message to his team, let's start looking for vulnerabilities, and didn't do it. And the one thing that we don't know from Equifax is whether that person is still employed with the company.
All right, so let's talk about another problem. We just talked about the patching process, but there's other difficulties with this, and I feel like you just kind of alluded to it. One thing that surprised me is that Equifax only does security reviews every quarter. That seems odd to me. Is that odd to you?
I mean, as somebody, you know, who's not an expert in that, it does seem odd. And what's amazing to me
four
in the reporting...
Four times a year?
Yeah, given how sensitive, you know, they have, you know, your social security number, your birthday, your credit card records.
Everything. Your past addresses, everything.
And something that I've learned in my reporting on this story is just how few regulations there really are from the federal government on this. There's very few guardrails in place about what these companies should be doing with your information in order to protect it. Nor are there regulations on the federal level to say, you know, Equifax, if you're hacked, you need to tell your customers in 5 days, 7 days, 2 weeks. There's nothing.
No, even though in the past that same discussion has come up when it related to Home Depot or to Target and other places as well. Then let's talk about how they treated consumer information, because a lot of people are very upset that Equifax didn't even encrypt the consumer information that they had stored. So they had all this information you just mentioned, all of your past addresses, everything that you might need, your mother's maiden name, everything somebody would need to steal your identity. They stored it. In plain language, it wasn't even encrypted. That, for me, was a huge takeaway. And I'm wondering what other kind of revelations you heard that surprised you.
Sure. For me, it boils down to the fact that one person can ultimately, you know, be responsible for this.
Right.
And I don't know if that's the former CEO just saying,
trying
to pin it on one person. But then he's going to his timeline. You know, it was at the end of May when the company figured out, hey, we got hacked.
We do have a problem, right.
And it took even longer for them to get the board involved, for him to get involved, for them to finally alert, you know, the feds, for them to come out with a response. It took weeks, you know?
Yeah, I'm a little bit biased on this because I actually did get hacked as a result of the Equifax. I am speaking with Tamar Hollerman. She is with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and she's been following the story on the Equifax hack. We would love to hear from you, especially if, like me, you actually had a hack or an identity problem because of the Equifax breach. You know how to reach us. It's 404-500-9457, or find us on social media. So then let's talk about another issue which came up, and I don't think we really got an answer to it. A number of politicians were asking whether or not this was nation state attackers. In other words, who was responsible and whether this could have come from outside of the country. Why can't we get an answer on this? Do we know?
Unclear at this point. I've read some reporting from places like Bloomberg that have suggested perhaps it was from Chinese hackers. And it was following patterns that we've seen in the past coming from China. But we don't know enough at this point about who these people are.
This is Atlanta Journal-Constitution Washington correspondent Tamar Hollerman. One last thing in the 40 seconds that we have left. What is the best way for someone to find out if they were part of this Equifax breach?
I think the best part is to be proactive. You can look up in Equifax's system to see if you've been a part of it, but my understanding is everybody has kind of been a part of it. So the best part is to be proactive, to call. To assume you have been, and to call the three credit reporting agencies, so Equifax and its two competitors, TransUnion and Experian, and to freeze your credit line.
Yeah, without worrying about whether you are, because most likely you are.
Most likely
part of
you
the
are.
Breach. Again, Tamar Hollerman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Last month, President Trump rescinded the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, better known as DACA. It's a pathway for children brought illegally to the U.S. to stay in this country. Those changes affect 24,000 people here in Georgia. But the action also includes a grace period, as long as people apply by tomorrow. GPB's Josephine Bennett explains.
When DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, was rescinded, applicants whose status was set to expire in the next 6 months were given one last chance to apply. But the October 5th deadline is fast approaching for DACA recipients like Maria Mraz from Eatonton.
I was 6 years old when I came to the United States, and up until I was 19, that's when I was able to apply for the DACA. I was here, without a status until DACA came in play.
And having DACA meant she was able to go to college, become a dental assistant, and support her 2-year-old son. But the DACA application can be complicated. It's 10 pages long and requires documentation of education, work history, and housing. So Maria is getting help at a free renewal clinic at Mercer University School of Law. It's one of 10 across Georgia and one of the few south of Atlanta. It's staffed by attorneys and law students like Jocelyn Calvillo, who is getting hands-on experience with clients. But for her, it's personal.
I have two of my cousins who are currently DACA recipients, and fortunately for them, they were able to renew before the deadline.
She says there's lots of uncertainty and fear among young people.
Many of them know just English or very limited Spanish, and so to be taken somewhere like Mexico, El Salvador, it's unfathomable for them because what do you do there, right? You've been raised here, you've created a future for yourself here, and with DACA being rescinded, what do you do now?
But she says the DACA program is not a permanent fix. It's just a promise that you will not be deported as long as you meet stringent requirements. Mark Jones teaches immigration law at Mercer. He says any fix needs to be permanent.
The real solution to all this is not what we're doing today, is not the DACA program, it's the DREAM Act. And, you know, President Trump says he supports a solution like that. So the question is how to make it happen.
The DREAM Act failed in 2007, but a similar bill put forward by Democrat Dick Durbin and Republican Lindsey Graham has been introduced in the Senate. That's good news for the thousands of people in Georgia under DACA. 20% of those need to apply for extensions by next week. Jennifer Moore practices immigration law in Macon and co-sponsored the clinic. She says not all DACA recipients had an unlawful entry. Many came with parents who started out with work visas.
I see pictures of people's passports and their little babies on their passports when they have a stamp of having entered, you know, or maybe they're a year or two old.
Maria Mraz says she has few memories of Mexico and has never been back. She considers the United States home.
I don't know what I would be going back to, because I don't have anything, and I don't have anyone that would tell me this is what you do, or, you know, because all my family's here.
She says she's hopeful Congress will act and come up with a permanent solution. But for now, she's grateful for the extra time she'll have for lawmakers to figure it out. For GPB News, I'm Josephine Bennett in Macon.
Tomorrow's the deadline for DACA recipients to apply for an extension. Congress has 6 months to approve an alternative to the program before it expires. Just ahead, eagles were nearly wiped out, but Georgia is now helping to raise scores of little baby raptors. First, though, is college once again becoming an option only for the wealthy? We look at inequality on campus. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. If you're rich, you have a much better chance of getting into college. The Equality of Opportunity Project finds top Ivy League schools admit more students from the top 1% of earners than the bottom 60% combined. But those schools get higher marks in that all-important U.S. News rankings of best colleges. So is that ranking system actually making the inequality gap worse? With me to discuss this is Tim Renick, Vice President for Student Success Programs at Georgia State University. GSU is actually a national model for graduating low-income students, though it slid 30 spots in the U.S. News rankings. Hello there. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And also with us by Skype is Mitchell Stevens, Professor of Sociology at Stanford University. Hi, Mitchell.
Good morning.
So I want to start with you, Mitchell, because I want to take on this theory people have that the rankings are actually encouraging colleges to accept kids who come from wealthier families. Do you buy that theory?
Well, the rankings reward colleges and universities for being more rather than less selective, for admitting fewer students rather than more students. And they reward schools for admitting students who have high grade point averages and standardized test scores. And we know that high standardized test scores especially parallel closely students' social class backgrounds. So to the extent that schools are encouraged to court a certain kind of young man or woman in their families, they do abet a certain kind of competition for wealthy high achievers.
Although you could make the argument that maybe it's the standardized tests that are part of the problem, right? Instead of the rankings?
Yeah, but I guess that would be sort of, pulling apart Siamese twins in a way. There's a whole bundle of competitive systems in the United States that are really hard to pull apart. And to the extent that we're expecting public flagship universities to increasingly compete with each other nationwide, rather than specifically serving the residents of their state, we're just encouraging this process.
So, Tim, did Georgia State, did you guys know it was going to hurt your rankings for you to pursue this goal of graduating more low-income students, of graduating more first-time college attendees? Did you know that might hurt you?
We were aware of the implications, yeah. One thing we did as we launched this program is looked at the correlation for our students between SAT scores and their chances of graduating, and we found almost no correlation. What was a much better indicator of student success were a lot of other factors, like what courses they took in high school and what their grades were. Those type of considerations don't tend to fall into the rankings and get weighed very heavily because they're hard to quantify. So SAT score is used a lot, but SAT scores doesn't really predict whether students will succeed at places like Georgia State. So we made a conscious effort. We said we're going to control for the factors that mean the most for our student success, not for SAT scores. And as a result, we've dropped over 20 points in SAT scores. At the same time, we've improved our graduation rates by 22 percentage points.
Yeah, it's incredible how many kids you're actually getting across that graduation stage. Let's hear this comment from Lynn O'Shaughnessy. She's with the University of California, San Diego, and she says the U.S. News rankings are actually bogus. That's basically her point.
It's not a scientific methodology. In fact, the major factor is what all the schools think of each other. So all schools in a particular category, like National University category, they all rank each other on a 1-to-5 scale every year. So, of course, it's absurd. What does somebody at San Diego State know about what's going on at University of Connecticut or University of Missouri, where I went to school? It's a flawed way of evaluating schools.
What do you think of that, Mitchell? Is she correct that it's not scientific?
Most academics and measurement experts agree with that the ranking systems themselves are not the best scientific indicators of quality, but that certainly hasn't prevented them from reorganizing the market for higher education. The bottom line is twofold. One is uncertainty, and the other is money. Families really don't know very much about higher education, and colleges and universities, frankly, don't make it terribly easy for families to understand relative quality. And so the rankings, fill in that gap of knowledge for families. The money part is that our public universities are increasingly seeking wealthy out-of-state families who pay high tuition rates to subsidize their bottom lines. We have systematically, nationwide, defunded public higher education. And it's an expensive proposition. So there's a very strong incentive for public universities across the country to court families who can pay high tuition rates.
So, Tim, at Georgia State, it appears to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, of course, that you have sort of redefined what success means for the university. There's the U.S. News rankings. You kind of have tossed that out in terms of defining whether you're succeeding in your mission. Is that accurate?
I think that is accurate. That, you know, what role should a public university in the middle of downtown Atlanta serve for the community? It should be able to support the students who need us, not go out of the state and try to find students with the best SAT scores and the strongest socioeconomic background. But the rankings force institutions to just that move if they want to move up in the rankings. Selectivity. If you reject more students, you rank higher in the rankings. If you spend more dollars per every student, you rank higher in the rankings. Many of the most important rankings don't take any consideration of the cost for per the student. What is the net cost of the education? And as a result, you can, as a consumer, be greatly misled by saying, I'm going to a high-ranked institution. It may not be the institution that serves you well.
Where, I mean, Mitchell, are we seeing the inequality gap? Because, look, in the broader American society, the income and inequality gap overall is extreme. Mm-hmm. Are we seeing a similar gap in universities?
The gap that you describe is unquestionably growing. A lot of us think back to what we like to call the good old days between 1950 and 1980, when the United States created the most accessible and affordable higher education system in world history. And we did that through massive investments by the federal government and state legislatures. The University of California system, the storied jewels and the crown of public higher education in California, were free to California residents for decades. That public commitment to underwriting the cost of higher education is just not there anymore. And colleges and universities are increasingly being driven by the need to bring in more dollars. And so just like in any market that requires private payers, the schools are very rationally in their way, seeking families who can pay the highest dollar. Georgia State and the University Innovation Alliance, of which it's a part, I think is an admirable effort to swim in the other direction. But it's a really hard current to swim against.
And part of that, Tim, is because of how universities are rewarded, right? I mean, if you're Harvard, you're rewarded over and over and over in reputation, in the amount of charitable dollars that you get. Is a school like yours, which has a completely different mission, do you feel as though in the broader educational marketplace you get the same sort of rewards?
Well, what's encouraging is that the reward system is shifting. Not the rankings are shifting. They've remained pretty constant. But there are voices out there now that recognize that if you are an institution that's graduating more low-income students, and Georgia State's now graduating more black students than any other college or university in the United States, our low-income students are graduating at the same rate as our middle and upper-income students.
I wonder if people realize how surprising that is.
And how very rare that is as well. There are just a couple schools nationally that can claim that. And so, we've had our own recognitions. Bill Gates was just visiting campus a few weeks ago. He was here for a keynote at the World Congress Center and invited himself to come and learn more about our programs. We've been invited to the White House. President Obama was a big fan of the kind of work we're doing and cited us and so forth. So it's nice to get those sorts of recognitions, but it makes even starker the contrast with an institution that is being recognized by the Gates Foundation and by the President of the United States. At the same time, it's moving down
in the
elite rankings, yes.
Let me play you this comment, Mitchell, from Carolyn Hawksby. She's at Stanford with you. Studies this issue of income diversity, and she says a number of high achievers but low income students don't apply to big schools.
That doesn't mean that they're rural, but that they're one of the only two or three very high achieving students in their high school. But the high school counselor doesn't have the time or the expertise to be able to help the students sort out the full range of colleges in the United States and know about all the financial aid opportunities that are out there.
So what is the solution here, Mitchell? And in addition, we'd have heard what Georgia State is doing. Are there things that we're not doing?
So I'm really glad you raised this work by Carolyn. I think that raises an additional contradictory dynamic in the sector, in which many social scientists, like Professor Hauksbee, are explicitly advocating that elite schools like Stanford and Harvard go out and scour the country to find those two or three highest achievers and recruit them to elite schools. There's another argument to be made. You know, why shouldn't those top students be going to places like Georgia State or excellent universities that are close to home? I'd say American academics at the moment, we can't decide whether we should cream the top students and send them all to Harvard, or whether we should do more to support the comprehensive universities like Georgia State that are closer to these young people and their families.
Tim, we only have a minute left, but I'm assuming that you would say send them to Georgia State.
We'd love to have them, and we think they have a great chance of succeeding. But I'll add one comment, that it's not just lack of knowledge, although that's important, that some of these students don't realize that there are Stanfords and Harvards out there that are willing to give them scholarships and pave the way for them to attend. We find with a lot of our low-income students, they're connected to their families in a very real and financial way. They're contributing, for instance, to the rent and the food costs for the household. And so staying close to home means the family prospering as well.
That is Tim Renick, Vice President for Student Success Programs at Georgia State. And you also heard Mitchell Stevens, Professor of Sociology at Stanford University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Pleasure being here.
The bald eagle, America's favorite bird, was nearly extinct when it was put on the endangered species list in the 1960s. But a record number of Georgia bald eagle nests, more than 200, have been documented by the State Department of Natural Resources. We talked about this with Bob Sargent, survey leader with the DNR.
My name is Bob Sargent. I'm program manager and wildlife biologist of Georgia DNR's Wildlife Resources Division. Well, it's good news. If you went back to the 1970s, for most of that decade, there were no successful nests of bald eagles in the entire state of Georgia, which is pretty humbling when you stop and think about that. Here we are, just finished another nesting season in Georgia, which occurs during the winter months, and we recorded a record for Georgia of 218 occupied nest territories in the state. So the species has come a long way. For much of the 20th century, eagles were poisoned, they were trapped, they were shot. The state of Alaska actually offered a bounty on bald eagle legs. If you turned in a pair of legs or the talons, you would get 50 cents in the early days to $2 per pair of legs. Poisoning was a problem. Sometimes it was deliberately targeting bald eagles. Habitat loss was a significant contributor to the decline of bald eagles in the United States. Perhaps 70% of their food base is fish. And so when you have contamination of waterways from pesticide usage, it travels up the food chain. We call it biomagnification. So it gets more and more concentrated, and of course eagles are at the top of the food chain. The other aspect of habitat alteration or habitat damage that contributed to the decline of eagles was the loss of old growth forests, particularly along waterways, because large old trees are where eagles nest. And by the 1920s in Georgia, most old growth in the state was long gone from logging operations. The efforts of a lot of biologists and private citizens, people with state and federal agencies, nonprofits, who worked together collaboratively, especially starting in the 1970s after the species was listed as endangered. The Southeastern's plan was established in the mid-1980s, and that plan required monitoring. It required research to determine other things that might be depressing eagle populations. The nests and the birds were protected, not only from just outright killing or harming them, but disturbing them during their nesting activities. So that was significant. Along the way, all the effort, all the sweat, all the labor that was exerted to bring this bird back from no active nests in the early 1970s in the state to 218 this past winter, we've learned many, many things that we can apply to other species that may be more in peril than the bald eagle. Conservation is something that we do every day. This is about responsible use of our natural resources so that they're available for future generations.
That's Bob Sargent with the Department of Natural Resources. You can report eagle nests at 478-994-1438 or go online at gadnr.org. Just ahead, do you hate getting out of bed in the morning? Well, new research says maybe you should hit snooze and get a little more shut-eye. It's on Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Tomorrow, we talk about weed in Atlanta. Now, if you're caught with an ounce or less of marijuana, you pay a fine instead of going to jail. So what do you think? Good idea? Or is this letting people off too easily? Give us a call and leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for that conversation. So how did you sleep last night? If you didn't get a restful 7 hours or so, my next guest may know why. Emory University professor Ben Rees says a good night's rest can be spoiled by a lot of things that we can't control. His newest book is called Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It was released in March. Ben joined us in May to talk about the effects of science and history on sleep. Good night of rest?
Pretty good. Yeah, not too bad.
Have you always had good sleep?
No. I've gone through periods of having really poor sleep, and I've had some periods where it's just come to me magically.
So what led you to this? You teach English, right, at Emory? What led you to sleep?
Well, I've been interested for a long time in connections between humanities and the health sciences, and I think, the humanities is often the under-examined side of the way we live our lives, and things that perplex us in contemporary world have histories that people in the humanities like myself can shed some light on. So I was really fascinated by why people seem so obsessed by sleep. Why in a time in our society when there's more restful and safe and hygienic sleeping conditions available to more people than ever before in human history, why so many people feel like they can't do it correctly. They have to train their children how to do it and sort of retrain themselves, put themselves under surveillance at night with sleep trackers. We were talking about this earlier.
I have a sleep tracker.
Yeah,
sure.
Right. I mean, so why do we, it's a basic human activity. Why all the fuss around it? And it seemed to me that it was something that the literary record, the documentary record of history could shed some light on.
So what was your first revelation? What was your first aha moment?
Well, the first aha moment was that, yes, true, 6 to 9 hours is the recommended amount, but there's nothing in nature that tells us that you're supposed to do it all at once. And the way that we're told to sleep from a very early age onward in our society is to kind of bundle all our sleep together into one package and do it all at night. And through most of the history of the species, sleep was broken up into several different components. Different cultures had different ways of, expecting, when and where people were supposed to sleep. But almost no society before around the 19th century in Europe and North America expected that people would do all their sleeping at once. Sleep scientists will tell us that naturally, we wake up 4 or 5 times in the middle of the night, even if we think we slept 6 to 9 hours. We've actually woken up a number of times checking the pillow, turning over, and so on. And for some people,
kicking the dog,
kicking your bedmate, checking your phone, whatever you do. And some of us don't really notice that happening. Others get up and then think, oh my God, I have insomnia.
The headline that's come out of this book, and I want to say it's the headline because the book is quite far reaching in terms of how far it goes into. But one of the things that has come out is that African Americans get less sleep than whites do. And you quote in there Thomas Jefferson, who said that black people simply require less sleep than whites. Why would an African American get less sleep now in 2017 than a colleague who's white?
Well, there are a lot of things that are unknown about that, but it's been widely documented in public health studies that there's something called a racial sleep gap, where we talk about that 6 to 9 hour recommended window for sleep. And African Americans are much less likely than whites to get that amount, both because more of them sleep less than 6 hours than white people do, and also because more sleep more than 9 hours, which can also be unhealthy, can be associated with depression and other kind of health problems. But, there are a lot of reasons for this, and many of them have to do with broken sleep environments. African Americans are more likely to live in noisy environments, overcrowded environments, unsafe environments, to work chaotic or unpredictable or undesirable work shifts that make it hard to sleep in an unbroken way at night. And so there are a lot of stressors on sleep that are quite different across the races.
And then again, that it ends up having all kinds of impact on their daily life when they are awake. And one thing which was very interesting, you point to the research of, I'm remembering the name, Tiffany Yip?
Yes.
At Fordham, who studies the effects of sleep on kids in school and how it can, beginning in the early grades, this can follow them through their entire school experience in terms of just not getting enough sleep changes an A student into a C or D student.
That's right. And one of the things she was really interested in is what are the effects of experiences of ethnic discrimination on young people, and how a negative encounter during the day can really profoundly affect somebody's sleep. And then it has carryover effects into the next day in terms of concentration or motivation or mood. And things can quite quickly snowball so that a problem or a conflict creates a broken sleep pattern. And then that broken sleep pattern makes the student less equipped to kind of carry on in the next day.
Yeah, if you bring this back to sort of the granular level, you're imagining this kid, this 8-year-old kid maybe in school who gets called a racial slur at school that affects their sleep that night, but then it happens again the next day and affects their sleep. So it becomes this cycle where they're just not getting enough sleep, which means they're going to perform less well in school. They're going to have less healthy relationships with other people because lack of sleep also affects your ability to be friendly, even,
yeah,
or have empathy.
Yeah, and where I went with this in my own research, and you mentioned that startling quote from Thomas Jefferson, is to say there's a history to the sleep gap and to the differences in expectations around sleep that go back to our history of racial inequality as a slaveholding nation. And Thomas Jefferson, of course, was a slaveholder, and he was looking in on a chronically exhausted population and saying, well, they require less sleep. And then he also noticed in his writing, he said, well, you know, at the end of a long day's work, the African American people on the plantation would fall asleep immediately. And he didn't attribute this to overwork or to physical exhaustion. He attributed it to a kind of intellectual insufficiency, that they couldn't keep themselves awake through powers of reflection to engage in intellectual activity and so on. So essentially justifying you know, the chronic exhaustion of a dominated population by saying, well, their bodies are just different and they don't need to sleep as much.
So do you feel like you, after all of this research that you did you come to a better understanding over why there's two things here, two questions it sounds like you started with. One, why are we so obsessed with sleep? And two, why aren't we getting enough? Did you get answers to those two questions?
Yeah, well, one of the answers that I got to the second question about why aren't we getting enough has to do with asking who the we is, right? And often these questions are asked in a way that presumes a sort of middle class, you know, economically comfortable person who's struggling with sleep psychologically. But when you look at kind of the broad span of sleeping practices and arrangements, for many people, the reason why they're not getting enough sleep is more simple and elemental than that, and that is they can't afford to. To be poor is to be chronically sleep deprived, and there are people, you know, across the world who are sleeping in very strange kind of patterns. Think about tech workers in India who are working in call centers catering to the, you know, technological needs of those of us here in the U.S. They've got to be working at 3-4 in the morning. Whole sectors of the economy have profound sleep disturbances. So I started dividing up who that we is and looking at different communities of sleepers and really what they struggle with.
So to a certain extent, this sleep obsession and anxiety is a privilege of wealth and sometimes race.
It is, in a way, and we buy our way into it, right? I mean, you have your sleep tracker. People have smart beds that monitor how much we perspire and move in the night. You can have anti-snore pillows, you know, all kinds of devices to sort of customize our sleep and try to optimize it for us, as well as, you know, multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical industry that we can use to tinker with our sleep. And that's to sort of cater toward these expectations towards sleep that again, as we talked about, are pretty historically novel. But for many people, they can't buy their way into it, and they're just left to sweep up whatever scraps of sleep they can find, in their condition.
That was Emory University professor Ben Reese. His latest book is Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. It's a pretty good time to be a sleep scientist. Earlier this week, three scientists won the Nobel Prize for Medicine for their work on circadian rhythm. That's also sometimes called the biological clock. It controls, among a number of other things, sleep. Joining us now is Assistant Professor of Neuroscience at Morehouse School of Medicine, Chris Allen. He was not on the Nobel Prize-winning team, but he's part of a team who just released their own findings about sleep. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I think we should emphasize, at this point, these are very preliminary findings, because there's no human trials yet.
Right. We've only done this in mouse.
But tell me what you found in mice with their sleep.
Okay. So we were interested in a gene. It's called BMAL1. And we knew that this gene, when it was turned off in a mouse, or we call it knocked out, it would increase the amount of sleep they had. And so we wanted to look into this further and figure out how this was going on. And long story short, what we found is that when we rescued it in the muscle, so we turned it off in the entire mouse and then rescued it in the muscle.
Turned it back on just for muscle tissue.
Turned it back on just in muscle tissue, that we saw a normal amount of sleep. Whereas when we rescued it in the brain, we still saw that increased sleep amount that we saw with the whole body knockout. So in essence, the data tell us that muscle is responsible for this effect of this gene BMAL1.
And this is surprising because for as long back as neuroscience research has been going on, we thought sleep was the province only of the brain, right?
Right, yeah. And I mean, we're neuroscientists, so we tend to focus on the brain.
Yeah. A hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
Right. I talk to some of my friends and they say, duh, that, you know, everybody else seems to know that the body has something to do with sleep. We were very, very surprised. And honestly, we thought there was something wrong. And we went through a series of experiments where we conditionally knocked it out in the muscle. And we really went through a bunch of steps to verify that BMAL1 in the muscle is necessary and sufficient to regulate sleep amount.
So something about our muscle tissue itself is regulating whether we get enough sleep or we don't get enough sleep. That was sort of your these preliminary findings.
Right.
So what is your next step? Because this, as I said, for me at least, brings up more questions than answers. So what are your next questions?
Right. So we're really interested in what kind of communication is going on between the muscle and the brain. And one of the things I didn't tell you about this BMOL1 is that BMOL1 is a core gene involved in the circadian clock. So it is critical for the functioning of the circadian clock. So it could be that clocks in muscle are actually what is regulating the sleep amount. Or the BMOL1 could be acting outside of the clock and doing something else. So genes could have more than one role, and that happens frequently.
And, I mean, it's only in mice, but do we have any inkling yet of whether or not the activity of the muscle during the day has anything to do with how that regulates sleep or doesn't regulate sleep? In other words, a more active mouse versus a more lazy mouse.
Yeah, well, we have some evidence in humans. So we know exercise improves sleep quality. So if you exercise during the day, it doesn't improve sleep quality at night, as long as you don't do it within 2 hours before sleep, and then it interferes with your sleep.
Because that wakes you up.
Right.
Right. But your evidence suggests that that's not merely a brain phenomenon, that actually may be happening in the muscle itself.
Right. So, yeah, it might be that some factor from the muscle is actually being released into the blood or somehow communicating with the brain. And that's what we're interested in figuring out, what that factor is. Is it a chemical? Is it some kind of neural communication?
Why is it so hard for us to understand sleep? Because at this point, we don't even know what the purpose of sleep is, right?
Exactly. And why is it so hard?
Yeah, why don't we know? We know it's important because almost every single species sleeps.
Right. I mean, almost every organism from flies to humans sleep. And I don't know why it's so hard. I suppose it's because we don't really have a way of looking at sleep outside of what the cognitive effects are, right? So
we can just watch the brain and what it's doing.
Right. I mean, we can do electroencephalography where we measure electrical waves on the surface of the brain, but as far as
what the evolutionary purpose is, how would we figure it out?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. So we don't really know what the evolutionary
purpose is.
Maybe
in 1,000 years as we watch the body evolve. We might see how it changed. I don't know. There's a lot of questions about sleep, more questions than answers. And I assume that your investigations will continue as you move forward with the muscle tissue. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We're going to keep working on it.
That's Chris Ellen, Assistant Professor of Neuroscience. More to come from the Morehouse School of Medicine. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today, but let's hear from you. We talked earlier about the Equifax hack and how basically everyone is affected by it, whether you think that you are or not. So how do you think this should be handled by the government? Should those responsible for dropping the ball at Equifax pay a fine, go to jail? What should the punishment be? Call us at 404-500-9457, leave a message, or post to Facebook and Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.